Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program author Steve Hendricks. We talked to him a few years ago about his book, An Unquiet Grave, The FBI and the Struggle for the Soul of Indian Country. His new book is called A Kidnapping in Milan, The CIA on Trial. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be back with you, Mary Charlotte.
This is the story of a kidnapping that took place in the winter of 2003, February 03, of an Egyptian Muslim cleric named Abu Omar. He was living in Milan, Italy, and he was taken to Egypt and tortured for 14 months under the CIA's Extraordinary Rendition Program. Who was Abu Omar? Tell us a bit about his life up until that point.
Abu Omar was born in 1963. He was an Egyptian who grew up in Alexandria. And Alexandria in the late 70s and early 80s was one of the particular hotbeds of the Islamic Brotherhood and of other even more extremist proponents of Islamic violence in Egypt. He got wrapped up in some of these groups and gave a lecture one day in his mosque that was anti-government. And when he got to the door of his mosque heading home, there were some security guys who met him, took him to jail, had him imprisoned, tortured, the whole nine yards of the horror of the Egyptian prison system. When he got out, he was terrified and fled the country, as so many extremist Muslims did. He went first sort of on the jihad trail. He went to extremist states like Yemen and then to Pakistan. He may also have gone to Afghanistan. And then he ended up among Islamic extremists on the fringes of the Balkans during the Bosnian War. And eventually he made his way, after all these travels, to Italy, which had a very lenient immigration policy. And in Italy, he set himself up eventually in Milan as a fiery preacher of Islamic sermons. Milan, in part because it had so many immigrants who were brought over for what was often degrading work, and they were often subject to many levels of discrimination. It was in some ways a perfect place for recruiting young Muslim men who were disaffected to become perhaps terrorists, certainly to become part of the more extremist fringes of Islam. And that's what Abu Omar did. And over time, he eventually became a sort of mid-level manager of a terrorist cell. He was a terrorist for sure, or a wannabe terrorist at least, but he was not a great mastermind terrorist, not someone who the CIA, by its own criteria, should have been extraordinarily rendering, its own criteria being that it wanted to get the worst of the worst of the terrorists off the streets.
We'll talk in a moment about the details of his kidnapping, but what happened when he went to Egypt and was in prison there for over a year?
After he was kidnapped, you're exactly right, he was flown to Cairo, where he was savagely tortured. These were horrific tortures, and they were so many that it's hard to know exactly where to begin. One example, though, that stuck in my mind was a torture where he was laid down on a mattress that had been soaked with water, and two wooden chairs were placed over him, one over his knees and one over his chest, and then two brutes, big heavy guys, were sat upon these chairs, and a shockingly strong, literally shocking, electric current was shot through the mattress. And so he would receive this horrific shock, but that wasn't the end of it. When he was shocked this badly, he would fly up off the mattress, crashing into these chairs, which was a pain in itself. Their main purpose, however, was to keep him in more or less constant current, contact with the current. And so he would crash into these chairs, be thrown back down to the shock of the mattress, be thrown back up again into the chairs, and on and on and on. You know, it's almost impossible for us to imagine. But so after about, as you say, 14 months of this, interestingly, Egypt actually has, though it has an authoritarian government under the so-called president, Mubarak, who's, of course, a dictator, it actually has a somewhat independent judiciary compared to the rest of the Arab Middle East, Middle Eastern countries. And he had lawyers, a lawyer or two, who figured out that he had been sent to Egypt, who worked for his release and eventually won an appeal to get him released. He was released under the condition that he spoke to absolutely no one about what had happened to him. But he called his family and friends back in Italy and eventually let drop, you know, sort of hints about what he had been through. No doubt the Egyptians were tapping his phones. And 3 weeks after he had been released, he was picked up again and held for another couple of years.
What was unusual about this case was that an Italian prosecutor, Armando Spataro, took this case and he indicted over 24 people, including CIA agents, U.S. Air Force, Italian agents. Tell us about this man, Spataro, and why he took the case.
Spataro is a strikingly charismatic and to me, heroic figure. He cut his teeth. He got his start as a magistrate, which is essentially a prosecutor, in the 1970s, during a period that the Italians know as the years of lead, lead for the material of bullets. It was a time that Italy was undergoing almost a low-grade civil war in which terrorists of the right and left were killing, assassinating, kidnapping, bombing hundreds and hundreds of people. To oversimplify the story a bit, he and his colleagues prosecuted, his specialty was terrorists of the left, prosecuted the terrorists out of existence. And then after that, he shifted to the no less volatile field of going after the mafia. And after that, started, you know, within shortly after 9/11, was shifted over to going after terrorists. So he was not at all to be put off by the fact that he was taking on, with this prosecution, the White House, that he was taking on the most powerful government in the world. He believes very passionately in the rule of law. And his view was that a kidnapping was a kidnapping. And it didn't matter whether it had been done at the bidding of the President of the United States or if it had been done by some mafia henchman. If they could kidnap Abu Omar today and not be prosecuted, they could kidnap any one of us tomorrow. So he went after this for that reason, and undaunted after, you know, his prior history. I mean, he had been marked for assassination by some of these groups, and a couple of his colleagues, you know, were in fact assassinated by leftist terrorists of the 1970s. So when he learned of this kidnapping, he went after it as a kidnapping. But, of course, he was fully aware of the political importance of this case. And he was an opponent of the Bush War on Terror, though he wouldn't quite say that himself, I don't believe.
Tell us a little bit about the kidnapping itself. I mean, it's striking how careless the CIA was in organizing the kidnapping. They left themselves wide open to being found out and prosecuted by Spataro.
It was stunning how ludicrous the CIA went about the kidnapping. And there were so many things they did wrong. The biggest one of them was that they used their cell phones like teenagers. They called each other, you know, scores and scores of times. But even more than that, they left their cell phones on all the time. Many people, everyone is, of course, aware that when you make a call, you're connected with a cell tower. But many people aren't aware that even when your phone is just powered on, but you're not making a call. Your phone is in constant communication, going back and forth with a cell tower, exchanging codes, checking its signal, and so on. When you do this in a dense city like Milan, where there are cell towers, you know, every few blocks, as you move around the city, being your phone being in connection with one cell tower after another, you essentially leave a trace of everywhere that you go. So, you know, the Spataro was able to, you know, they knew when Abu Omar had disappeared. He had disappeared on a walk one day to the noon prayers at his mosque from his apartment. It was a walk of, you know, 8-10 blocks or something like that. So they knew the narrow area in which he had been kidnapped. And by tracing all these various movements of all the cell phones that were within that range at the time, and there were thousands, tens of thousands, but through using some great software, incidentally, that the CIA had given them before to track terrorists with, they were actually able to track down these CIA kidnappers. And then because the CIA officers had used these cell phones rather than, say, untraceable satellite phones, to call one another over and over, even the ones who weren't right there at the moment of the kidnapping, even those who had come months before to plan it or who were supervising from afar, they were able to track down those people, or at least to track down the aliases that they had used while in Italy when they set up their cell phone accounts. Many of these folks, their real names were never discovered by the Italians. Now, the cell phones weren't the only things. They had also paid for hotels that they stayed in with credit cards rather than cash, which would be the standard spy trade craft. They had rented cars where they had, you know, shown their passports and international driver's license. A few of them even gave frequent flyer numbers at hotels and rental car agencies. You know, Lord only knows why they were doing that. Perhaps they suspected or wished, that if Abu Omar was getting a free trip out of this rendition, that they deserved a free trip too. You know, who knows? But the fact that this was going on was just stunning to me. And when it was all revealed was, frankly, stunning, I'm sure, even to many people within the CIA.
There is a big question about that, which is the CIA incompetent, or do they just think that they can do anything they want in a country which is basically an ally of the United States? What was going on?
It's both of those. There's a hubris to what the CIA does that runs all throughout its history, back to the founding in 1947. You know, there was a great book that was written a few years ago by Tim Weiner, a New York Times reporter, called Legacy of Ashes. It won the Pulitzer Prize. And his basic theme in this massive book, to oversimplify it, is that the CIA almost never got any major thing right. You know, they didn't see the Iranian Revolution coming on. They didn't see the fall of the Soviet Union. Operation after operation after operation, they botched. And the kidnapping in Milan was completely in keeping with this. Partly, though, it was even some things in the war on terror were even worse than normal because, you know, the Bush administration, after 9/11, and this kidnapping of Abu Omar was only 18 months after 9/11, the Bush administration had placed such a demand on the CIA, particularly for extraordinary renditions, that it didn't have enough people who were experienced in them to carry them out. So it sent a lot of unqualified officers, I think unqualified officers, into the field, may also have been unqualified contractors, because the CIA contracts out an enormous amount of its work to companies like Blackwater, who we've heard about, and so on, many groups we haven't heard about. And these people went into the field and did work that they just weren't able to pull off credibly. And the managers back in Langley weren't able to supervise them in a way that they needed to supervise them. So that was one piece of it. And then the other piece of it was that they never thought that they could get caught, certainly not in Italy, which was one of the first countries to line up behind the Bush War on Terror. At the time, Italy was under the rule of Silvio Berlusconi, the right-wing prime minister. It's now under him again. And Berlusconi was such an ally of Bush. And the CIA equivalent in Italy, a military organization known as SISMI, SISMI was such an ally of the CIA that they didn't think that they could possibly go wrong. And if something went wrong, that they couldn't possibly get caught. What they didn't count on was two things. One, there are many police agencies, which of course the CIA knew throughout Italy. SISMI was not in charge of the investigation into Abu Omar's crimes. The Italians had Abu Omar under investigation long before he was kidnapped. There was a local anti-terrorist organization called DIGOS, and they were in charge of the investigation into Abu Omar. They had been learning great things about his cell, all of which was just their investigation was smashed when the CIA came in and swiped them out from under their noses without telling them. DIGOS was appalled, offended, and they were eager to go after the CIA when they figured out that the CIA had done this. And similarly, the Italian prosecutors are independent. They are like our judges, our federal judges in the United States. They have life tenure. They can do what they want. They are not under the control of the central government in Rome. And that is exactly what happened. The prosecutors of Milan have a reputation for integrity, for not being intimidated, even going after the prime minister or cabinet ministers, and that's what they did.
We're talking to Steve Hendricks about his book, A Kidnapping in Milan, The CIA on Trial. I think it's important also to talk about the fact that the CIA had been active since World War II in Italy in subverting their elections in both what they call soft and hard tactics, both through force and through persuasion, and totally undermining the democratic process that our country is supposed to be about.
That's exactly right. Italy, after World War II, had one of the strongest, perhaps the strongest, communist parties in all of Europe. And nothing terrified the CIA more than that a European country would elect a communist government. And it didn't matter to the CIA that any socialist, communist government, whatever, would be bounded by a constitution, a democratic constitution of that country. So it wouldn't be totalitarian communism, as we know from the Soviet Union and so on. It would be a democratic communism. Didn't matter to the CIA. So after World War II, when the Italian government was being set up, the CIA dumped tons and tons of money. There are all these stories of black bags being passed between CIA officers and businessmen in Rome who then funneled it further and laundered it into the Christian Democratic Party, which was the center-right party of dominant party of Italy. And to make a long story short, year after year, election after election, the CIA did this, and the Christian Democrats stayed in power. Now, it's impossible to say what influence this money had, to say nothing of all the little think tanks and, right-wing magazines and newspapers and so on that the CIA set up. But I think we can be safely assured that if the CIA didn't think it was important, it wouldn't have been done. One of the most fascinating things to me, and one I frankly didn't believe when I first went into the researching of it, was that not just dumping money into Italy, the CIA also set up a covert army in coordination with NATO. They did it not just in Italy, but in almost every country of Western Europe. This covert army in Italy was called Gladio, as in the name of its sword that gladiators used to fight with in ancient times. And what Gladio was essentially a group of right-wingers, hard right-wingers, extremists, who were armed, who were first trained in secret military bases. One of them was in Sardinia, off the coast of Italy, and were then sent back out across Italy and were given machine guns, explosives, grenades, what have you, in order to be ready to mount an insurrection should communists take power, whether by election or force, in Italy. And, of course, when you train people and give them the idea that they don't need to abide by a democratic election and that the people that they are confronting are entirely evil, then they start to get itchy and think that maybe they ought to take things into their own hands to make sure that we don't reach the point where we need to go fight a war. So there's a lot of very suggestive evidence that's hard to confirm, but is, I think, more probable than not, that these right-wingers, who the CIA and NATO trained and armed, went about doing some of that right-wing terrorism that I spoke about in the years of lead in the 1970s. If so, and again, I caution that it's not 100% certain, but I would say, again, better than not, if so, the CIA has a lot of blood on its hands.
And, of course, that manufactured right-wing terrorism then gives rise to genuine left-wing terrorism, of which there was a great deal in Italy.
It's true. For many years, people had thought that the terrorism was really kicked off by the left wing. The first huge terrorist bombing was in Piazza Fontana in Milan. It was a bombing at a bank, and people just assumed that if you're bombing a bank, why, it wouldn't be the right-wingers doing it. It would be the left-wingers doing it. And it was after Piazza Fontana that just everything fell apart. The years of lead really date from that bombing. Well, over the years, it turned out that Piazza Fontana was not the left-wingers doing it. It was the rightists, and they were doing it to throw blame on the left. And they were doing it in order to incite and spark the left to rise to their own terrorism. And in doing so, to discredit the Communist Party, the Socialist Parties, and hopefully to push the populace of Italy to return to fascism, in essence. Now, they didn't succeed in all of that. They did succeed. There were other causes, of course. It's more complicated than just a single cause. But this did help discredit the far left, the Communist Party. It did push the government in Rome to adopt some rather draconian restrictions on civil rights and so on. It brought to bear almost a form of soft fascism. You know, once again, if the CIA had the role that it seems very likely that they did have in this, that's extremely damning. And because they probably did, and at a minimum, they were allied with these groups and supported them and gave nods to them that they weren't going to stand in the way of them or other rightists who were, you know, advocating coups and things like that. Assuming that all this is true, and we know that a big chunk of it is, this is a huge part of why the CIA just didn't think that it could get caught, and if it got caught, that it couldn't get nailed for the kidnapping of Abu Omar in Milan.
Meanwhile, as you were talking about before, Italians were doing their own form of counterterrorism, which was very different from the American form. What did it look like, and how was it working?
You know, Milan, it so happens, because of a confluence of factors, might be thought of as the historic seat of Islam in Italy. It's, in fact, one of the most potent such seats in all of Europe. For many years, before Islamic terrorism blossomed into the form that we came to know it, Islamist extremists in Milan were sending men and money off to radical causes in North Africa and Bosnia and Afghanistan and so on. Because of this, and because the police of Milan are particularly competent, they became extremely good and extremely knowledgeable at going after Islamic terrorists. And as you said, they don't go after them with the lawlessness of illegal war and rendition and torture. They do not view these people as warriors. They view them as criminals, the same as they viewed the terrorists of the years of lead, the same as they view the mafia. So they go after them with old-fashioned investigations. They go after them with surveillance. They go after them with informers. They go after them eventually with arrests and prosecutions and trials. And the folks of Milan, the anti-terrorists over there, have probably put away more terrorists in their one relatively small jurisdiction through the rule of law than the entire U.S. government had put away through the lawlessness of rendition and torture and so on. So they had their eye very early on Abu Omar shortly after he arrived in Milan. And they were learning a great deal, as I said earlier, about what was going on inside his cell, which particularly was an attempt to recruit young men and send them off to fight the Americans in the soon-to-be-fought war in Iraq that everyone knew was going to happen very soon, and perhaps to become suicide bombers. That's not entirely clear, but it's certainly possible, maybe even probable. The police were a month, maybe two, away from arresting Abu Omar once they had milked everything they could out of his cell. And then, of course, the CIA swooped in and took him before they could find all that about him. So that's another reason why the CIA's decision to render Abu Omar was completely ridiculous. You know, the CIA had him well enough under surveillance that they were going to know whether he was going to become violent, whether he was going to carry out any attack imminently. And he wasn't. He had no such plans, and they would have known if those changed. And since they were going to arrest him anyway, and all of his colleagues after he was rendered were arrested, tried, and convicted, you know, since that was almost certainly going to happen to him anyway, there was no reason whatsoever to take this guy out.
One does wonder why they didn't have a more cooperative and communicative relationship, the Italian and the U.S. anti-terrorist forces, who supposedly were working toward the same ends.
Well, you know, they had a very cooperative relationship on one level. So, for example, the CIA was working hand in glove with DIGOS, which was this local organization that was anti-terrorist police organization that was tracking Abu Omar. They had often worked with them against terrorists, and they were in fact coordinating all their work to, you know, build the evidence that the Italians would need to prosecute Abu Omar. So, you know, they definitely were in great contact with these people and sharing useful tips and information. Now, the problem was that the CIA knew that DIGOS would be opposed to taking out Abu Omar. And so they, you know, didn't want to read them in, didn't want to tell them that this was part of their plan. The plan originated in Rome at the CIA station in Rome with the station chief, a fellow by the name of Jeff Castelli. And Castelli pushed forward with the rendition over the objections of his CIA bureau chief in Milan, a fellow by the name of Bob Lady. Lady had a great relationship with DIGOS in Milan. He did not want that disrupted. He fully saw and understood that when the CIA carried out this rendition, DIGOS was almost certain to find out about it. And when that happened, of course, there would be a rupture in their relationship. That's exactly what happened. Lady went ahead and went forward and carried out the rendition as ordered. He was a loyal soldier. But you know, eventually, when it was found out, there was this breach of trust between DIGOS and the CIA. It's a very good example, to my mind, of how our conducting of the war on terror actually made us less safe from terrorism, because then the CIA and DIGOS weren't doing their very fine work of going after terrorists together.
Why, of all people, did they decide to render Abu Omar to Egypt, the CIA?
Well, you know, very shortly after 9/11, Jeff Castelli, the CIA station chief, went to his counterpart at CISME, this CIA equivalent in Rome, and presented the chief of CISME with a list of about a dozen names and said, would you help us render any one of these people? Now, we don't know who all was on the list. Perhaps there was a major terrorist or two on the list. The few who we do know didn't seem to be big terrorists. You know, they just wanted someone whom they could render, because shortly after 9/11, the cachet of doing an extraordinary rendition was high. Jeff Castelli was ambitious. He wanted to rise in the agency, and he had people higher up than him in the agency who were grooming him for more important posts. And one of those people was a fellow by the name of Steve Kappas, who was the main person, really, who was in charge of saying yes or no to approving extraordinary renditions that were suggested by station chiefs around the world or by the counterterrorism unit in Langley. So Kappas was grooming Jeff Castelli, and if my sources inside the CIA are correct, you know, Kappas fudged the intelligence, or at least went along with Castelli's fudging of the intelligence in Italy to make it seem that Abu Omar was a more dangerous character than he was, to make it seem that he needed to be taken off the streets in whatever way possible, because the Italians, according to him, at least according to my sources in the CIA and in Italy, according to Castelli, these sources say that he was, claiming that Abu Omar could mount an attack without the Italians knowing it was coming. And one of the attacks that he was supposedly about to mount, an attack that the Italian authorities tell me had no basis in reality whatsoever, was against the American School of Milan. So if we believe all these sources of mine, and I do, they're trustworthy and good, the motivation for carrying this out was essentially bureaucratic. It was that Castelli wanted a promotion and others wanted to promote him. And, there was no consideration of country involved here. It was a consideration of career.
But, I mean, underneath that, the idea that there was cachet in kidnapping a person or, by whatever means, taking them to another country to have their body so thoroughly and unimaginably brutalized and their mind destroyed, that's like a cool, glamorous, promotion-worthy thing to do, that's unbelievable. It's horrifying.
It is horrifying. And, you know, we have to take ourselves back to the mentality that was back then, in many ways, still exists now. You know, after 9/11, these people, terrorists and suspected terrorists, were demonized. They were not merely bad guys. They were evil. They were on a level with, the Nazis of Germany and so on. You know, we have many people in this country who believe that we can do with these folks absolutely whatever we want. Most of these people don't understand that torture is not just a crime. It is a crime against humanity. The United States has signed several treaties. The Rome Convention, for example, which defines torture as not just a crime, but a crime against humanity, and has even made, the U.S. has made the U.N. Convention Against Torture national law. And it provides for, if you send people off to torture in another country, you can be fined, you can be imprisoned, and if the person who you torture dies, you can even be given the death penalty, which is to say that this is such a heinous crime, one of the most heinous crimes imaginable, that we are even, at least on the statute books, willing to, to give a president or a head of the CIA or whoever the death penalty, or at least allow that option. Now, of course, that's not going to happen. political will for even a prosecution for a mere misdemeanor under this statute is impossible. But, you know, bear in mind that this is not the kind of thing that we are hearing every day. You know, bear in mind that most people don't know the absolute horror of the torture that we are subjecting people to. It's part of why I wrote the book. I wanted to show not just that it was wrong to torture an innocent person, as we've rendered some innocent people who were subjected to some of this brutal treatment, and not just wrong to torture a lesser criminal, but it's wrong and degrades us and makes us complicit in a greater evil when we send off even evil people to be tortured.
If you believe that evil is a concept that you can really apply to people, which is a whole other discussion, but one of the things you point out in the book is that with all of these people who go through these rendition programs and who are tortured in, I have to say, ways that are so brutal that if anybody, you or me or anyone listening to this show, had gone through the first minute of what this guy endured, we'd be scarred for life, much less 14 months of it. But no useful intelligence tends to come from this stuff.
It's true. And, you know, the CIA knows this, or absolutely should know this. You know, there's this claim that you can get good intelligence, obviously, out of torture. We hear this claim all the time. And, you know, you may get good intelligence out of torture, but you won't know it because you're getting everything. The person who's being tortured will tell you absolutely everything, anything they think you want to hear. And there's absolutely no way you can sort out the truth from the fiction. There's a story from the 1960s of a Vietnamese prisoner during the Vietnam War who was tortured under the CIA's Phoenix program. He told his torturers that he was the son of the King of Siam. He told his torturers that he was a hermaphrodite. He told his torturers that he was a high-ranking archbishop. He was a simple teacher. He was saying everything he could to get them to stop torturing him. And, you know, the CIA has studied torture throughout the years. Early on in their history, they were very interested in the Soviet torture and what results they were getting out of this during the Cold War. So they commissioned their own studies and studied past studies. And they are aware, for example, of a seminal study that was written by, or more sort of a case study, not a scientific one, that was written by a Marine Corps officer who was an intelligence officer during World War II. And he had Japanese prisoners who were captured in the Pacific Islands battles toward the end of the war. And you have to bear in mind that back then, these Japanese soldiers were viewed about the way we view Islamic terrorists today. They were viewed as nearly subhuman, as completely evil, as a force that we couldn't ration with, have rational discussion with, a force that absolutely could not be subject to humane discourse. Well, this Marine Corps officer decided that he was actually going to treat these people as humans. Gave them cigarettes, he talked to them kindly, let them know that they weren't going to be hurt. And within 48 hours of talking to some of these people, he had complete order of battle plans for the Japanese troops on some of these islands and probably saved thousands and thousands of lives in battles like Okinawa and so on. This is the kind of thing that the CIA is aware of. They know the good intelligence is more likely to be gotten from humane methods. They don't do it anyway. They don't do it, or at least didn't do it for such a long time, because it's cheap and easy. It's quick. You think you can get something out of torture. Intuitively, you think, yeah, I'm going to torture someone, and they're, of course, going to tell me, the truth of the matter. It's not true, but it's alluring, and the CIA and the United States in general gave in to that allure in the war on terror.
Do you think there's just a culture of bloodlust going on?
Well, there's certainly during the Bush administration, I would say there was something very much like that. I mean, Bush had a cowboy culture for sure. He had a take-no-prisoners culture for sure. And that filters down. You know, we often wonder, or at least those of us who cover these sorts of things, wonder, how does that play out on, you know, throughout the agencies that have to carry out his orders? And, you know, there's at that time a colorful, for lack of a stronger word, character who ran the counterterrorism unit in the CIA named Kofor Black. And he would say things like, I want this terrorist's head on a plate. I don't want to see this terrorist unless he's got flies on his eyeballs. You know, when you have that kind of culture, it's impossible for lesser people, for people who, you know, are susceptible to doing what everyone else does, it's impossible for them not to go along with it. Now, that said, having also looked at the folks who were doing the torturing in Egypt for our torture by proxy, some of these guys are complete sadists. They were born torturers in the same way that some serial killers are probably born serial killers. But many are not. Many are made torturers, and they're made it in large part by habituation to the kind of bloodthirsty culture and so on that you talk about, and wouldn't otherwise be evil people or, you know, do evil deeds in some parts of their lives. They would be normal people who you would meet on the street, and they still are. When they leave their torture behind, you'd meet them on the street, and they're just the nicest people in the world. We are susceptible to the circumstances that we're put in and the influences around us.
We're talking to Steve Hendricks about his book, A Kidnapping in Milan, The CIA on Trial. So let's go back to the CIA on trial part of it, which is that here we have this Italian prosecutor in Milan, Armando Spataro. He got indictments and he got convictions. That's extraordinary. Did anybody actually serve time?
Nobody has served time. There were 26 people whom he indicted. One of them was an Air Force colonel. The rest were CIA officers or alleged CIA officers. He got 23 convictions. The three who got off had diplomatic cover in Rome rather than working out of the consulate in Milan. The judge in Milan said that he felt that this, his reading of the laws, were that their working out of the embassy in Rome conferred on them a greater immunity than those in Milan. So he wasn't saying they were innocent. He was merely saying that they were immune from consideration. So these 23 who were convicted were convicted for terms of from 5 to 8 years, depending upon their degree of involvement. Spataro was happy with the verdict, but he was not entirely satisfied. He had asked for longer sentences and wanted those three convicted, so he appealed. And within the last month, an appeals court upped those sentences slightly, a year or two in each case, and is still considering the question of whether to convict these people supposedly with diplomatic immunity. Now, these convictions are good anywhere in the European Union. If any of these spies sets foot in the EU and is identified, he or she is to be arrested and forwarded to Italy to serve their jail terms. Now, about two-thirds of these convicted spies were convicted under aliases, the aliases that they used while in Italy. So it's extremely unlikely that they would actually be arrested. However, a handful of reporters, myself included, have learned the true identity of some of these agents. And, you know, they have to worry that the Italian prosecutors and investigators have learned their identities as well. So it's a very frightening thing for these people to think that really anywhere they travel abroad, I mean, they could go to Mexico for that matter, and if Mexico so chose, they could arrest them and forward them to Italy. It's a daunting thing for them, and it's a chilling factor, I think a good one, to all CIA officers who might carry out these illegal operations. All of these people had fled Italy, had left well before the trial began. The only one who really lost something was Bob Lady, the CIA bureau chief in Milan, who by the time of the prosecution, a couple years after the kidnapping, had retired to a grand villa and estate with 10 acres of vineyards and so on. He was going to live his wonderful retirement there. He had to flee when the CIA got word that the prosecution was coming down because they had moles inside the Italian police and prosecutors' offices and so on. But he lost his very grand estate. And in addition to the prison sentences that he and the others got, they were fined a big chunk of money, about €1.5 million. And in Italy, you don't just pay that fine to the government. You actually pay it in restitution, if possible, to the victim of your crime. So his estate has now been taken. It's being held in escrow while the appeals of his sentence are being done by a public defender and so on. If he loses, however, then his estate will be sold, and the proceeds will go to Abu Omar and his wife. An ultimate irony that the guy you set out to kidnap and that you did these horrible things to is going to essentially get your estate.
When you write a book of this kind, which I have to say is so beautifully written, you have a novelistic and literary style. When I started reading this, at first I was like, is this a novel or is this a nonfiction book? But it's fair, it's comprehensive, there's a luxury in being able to include all the details and the history and background of each issue that you take on. What kind of feedback have you gotten so far, and what effect do you hope the book has?
Well, it's a real mix of feedback. You can look at my work as, I think of, as literary journalism. And the folks who look at it from a literary point of view have much the same view as your very kind view that you just stated. They like the book as a great story in the same way that they might have liked, say, A Civil Action, even though they weren't necessarily interested in a 10-year-old case about a chemical poisoning trial in Woburn, Massachusetts. And then other people like it because of the political statement. And of course, these overlap. Some people like the politics and the literature of it. Our mainstream media in America has so soft-pedaled torture and rendition, they can hardly refer to American tortures as torture. I mean, even NPR refuses to refer to waterboarding, which by any definition is torture. They just refer to it as enhanced interrogation techniques. So many people appreciate what I think of as a corrective in view. It's not a radically left view in my mind. It's a humane view. So the people who view it as political or literary are folks who tend to like the book. The people who don't are the folks who are more on the journalism end of the scale. You know, I had a review in the New York Times Book Review a couple of months ago, and it was by one of the national security reporters for the Times, and he was, I think, somewhat mystified by why I bothered to go into all this stuff about torture and so on. He was not the least interested in any judgment passed on the work that America had done. He certainly wasn't interested in the quality of the writing. What he was interested in was the inside the Beltway politics of it. He wanted to know what went on the seventh floor of the CIA. That's where the top officials are. He wanted to know who inside the White House had approved this. I didn't focus on that. I focused on all this other stuff because my point was, we know, ultimately, who approved this. All this was coming down from the Bush White House. It was the policy of the United States to carry out these renditions. The important story here, the story here that the mainstream media hasn't told, is the moral implications of these renditions. And my going into that has not been a big hit with folks in the mainstream media.
Steve Hendricks is author of the book, A Kidnapping in Milan, The CIA on Trial. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thanks for having me back. It's been great.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.